Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. February 12th is Darwin Day, the birth date of both Abraham Lincoln and Charles Darwin. Professor Stephen Fuller has written a play about the philosophy of both men, their worldviews, and how they might respond to modern society. The play is Lincoln and Darwin, One Night Only. Why don't we first start with you describing a bit about yourself. Where do you teach and what do you teach?
I'm a professor of sociology at the University of Warwick, and I hold a chair in what's called social epistemology, which is a field that I founded about 25 years ago now. I started a journal and wrote the first book in the area. Social epistemology is about the social foundations of knowledge. I'm trained in the United States. My PhD was from the University of Pittsburgh in history and philosophy of science. I've now been a professor in Britain for 17 years and at Warwick for 12 years. And I generally teach stuff in the sociology of science, sociology of knowledge more generally.
You wrote a play, Lincoln and Darwin, for One Night Only. Tell us about the inspiration for that and what the play's about in broad strokes.
Well, the play was meant to coincide with the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln, both of whom were born on the same day, February 12th, 1809. And this play was specifically designed for the annual meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, which is basically the largest body and actually the oldest body in the world for the promotion of science to the general public. It was started in the middle of the 19th century, and at that time, I was actually the president of the sociology division of that association, and so I get to stage a presidential event. Usually the presidential events are panels, but I decided to write a play and stage it at that time.
And what's been the reaction to the play so far?
Well, actually, it's been, you might say, mixed reaction. It certainly got a lot of coverage. It got covered in the Times Higher Education Supplement, which is sort of the equivalent of the Chronicle of Higher Education in Britain. And it got covered in the New Scientist. And the play has been performed several times, both in Britain and even in Australia. And I think the thing about the play, and you'll probably want to be going into it more, is the fact that it sort of presents a kind of mixed picture about especially how Darwin would regard both the development of culture and of science since the time he was living. Because basically the premise of the play is that both Lincoln and Darwin are being brought back to life, at least temporarily, in the context of a chat show where they have an option to either stay in the year 2009 or to go back to where they came from. And Darwin, at the end of the play, decides to go back while Lincoln decides to stay.
You've got the two characters, Jack and Sheila, the game show hosts, teasing their guests, getting the answers out. Why did you feel it was important to discuss the idea of scientific and social progress since Darwin? What did you see was at stake in that discussion? And what were you hoping to have Darwin and Lincoln get across to the audience?
Well, I think the thing is that Darwin, I think, generally speaking, had a rather pessimistic view of just how much science could enhance the human condition when it got right down to it. I think there's a sense in which Darwin believed that the universe was fundamentally unintelligent and that the randomness, or at least the blindness of natural selection to the interests and purposes of human beings and any other conscious creatures, meant that people who thought that by engaging in scientific activity you could somehow make the human condition better, that there would always be limitations to it. And I think a good example that comes up in the play is that in Darwin's own day, there was beginning to be a movement that was championed, actually, by his friend Thomas Huxley to use animals in experimentation. And Darwin had a very cautious view about that. Darwin believed at the end of the day that, yes, it's true that animals and humans had a lot in common and so forth, but that he really didn't think that we could learn very much that would be of use to improving the human condition, while at the same time we would end up causing an enormous amount of suffering to animals. So Darwin, I think, by today's standards, would be one of these people who would want to put quite a lot of limitation on the use of animal experiments, for example. And I think that's just one example of the extent to which Darwin had a generally pessimistic view about science's relation to social progress. And in this respect, I think he's given a kind of rude awakening by the program. Because the program keeps on saying, well, you know, we've done all these wonderful things in science, and the more we look into the nature of life and so forth, the more it looks like it's been intelligently designed, and we can figure out how it works. And I think this really causes Darwin quite a shock.
In the play, you have Lincoln very enthusiastic about the idea that man is made in the image of God, although he does doubt that the founders were serious rather than pragmatic about the idea. For Lincoln, where do the moral and legal rights really come from? And then for Darwin, where do the moral and legal rights really come from?
Well, I think that Lincoln was very strongly committed to the dignity of human beings. He did believe that we were created in the image and likeness of God, but I think what Lincoln was not persuaded by was any particular established religious gloss on that idea, okay?
Right.
So he bought the general idea, and this is where I think he has some sympathy with deists and people like that, who have a very sort of stripped-down version of this notion. Yes, we're created in the image and likeness of God, but from that it's not clear how much follows with regard to specific morality and politics and so forth, other than there's fundamental human dignity. And I think that's where he's coming from. Darwin's view is, I think, quite different. I think Darwin basically, whatever human rights one might want to talk about, I think is going to be based on the kinds of rights that are associated with the dignity of sentient beings, right? So the prevention of undue suffering, that kind of thing. So in this respect, Darwin, I think, would have a view that would be rather close today to somebody like Peter Singer, who in a sense sees human rights and animal rights as basically part of the same mix, and that in a sense what we're always trying to do is to expand the moral circle, because in a sense the kinds of things that we're most concerned about when we're preserving our existence and asserting our dignity are to a large extent things that other sentient creatures also are entitled to. And I think Darwin would be more along those lines. I don't think he believed in the specialness of human beings, whereas I think Lincoln did.
Well, I think that overlaps with my next question, which is, how did Darwin's theory of natural selection coarsen, as Lincoln would put it, or does put it in your play, our understanding of human nature? Or to put it in another way, how does the political world change when human beings are seen as part of a continuum with the animals rather than separate from the animals?
This goes to the issue of whether there's some sort of overarching purpose to life, to human life in particular. The thing about natural selection that's so problematic, I think, and remains problematic today, is that it really divorces the idea of purpose from anything having to do with life or nature. So if there's purpose, it's in a sense something made up. It's something fictional. It's not something that, as it were, is in the grain of the way reality normally is. And I think as a result, then, there's a tendency to sort of downsize, you might say, the question of the meaning of life. So the question of the meaning of life then becomes, how can you survive in the most effective way possible for the few number of years you happen to be on the earth? And that typically ends up boiling down to avoiding pain and maximizing pleasure, but only to the extent that it avoids pain. So you end up having this very sort of unambitious notion of what it is to live a human life. I mean, one of the things you don't have very clearly is the idea that there's some kind of intergenerational project, that is to say, some sort of longer trajectory, whether we talk about it in theological or scientific terms, whereby, you know, our children, our grandchildren, building upon the legacies of the past, might come about and do something really magnificent and realize some overarching goal. It seems to me the idea of natural selection really goes against any of that kind of thinking that we historically associate with progress. And I believe this is the kind of thing Lincoln would have pointed to as involved in the coarsening of human nature that comes from natural selection.
If natural selection is taken seriously in the political realm and becomes the dominant worldview, describe the impact that might have in terms of, say, a genetic sliding scale of rights.
It's a tricky issue in a way. To be honest, if you really use natural selection as the basis for your politics, you'd be concerned about two things. The first thing you'd be concerned about is a general kind of ecological balance. So in other words, you'd be worried about that human beings might introduce, as it were, artificial conditions that enable humans to expand and populate at the expense of other creatures, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, that kind of strategy will fail in the long term, but in the short term, it will cause an enormous amount of damage to ecosystems. And so I think one of the things you'd be concerned about is you'd want to be monitoring and curtailing human populations. Now, there are lots of ways of curtailing human populations, of course. One might think about contraception, but I think actually the sort of view that was much more in line with a kind of straight Darwinist thinking was just to let people die. In other words, do not have any kind of advanced welfare systems or public medical care systems that might actively keep alive and promote the existence of people who under normal circumstances might be struggling to survive. And so there's a kind of, you might say, laissez-faire attitude that is in fact an expression that gets coined during the period of social Darwinism, where in a sense you sort of see human life and death as just part of the natural cycle, and the fact that people die isn't taken to be particularly morally significant, right? It's just sort of part of the way nature works. You know, species come and go and individuals come and go. And so one shouldn't, as it were, invest too much effort into something that in a sense is a losing battle anyway, because everybody dies in the long term.
What's your preferred basis for human rights? Is it moral reasoning, sentience, biblical literacy? What's the basis for human rights? Maybe a soul would be a better way to put it.
I think, yeah, the two issues here. I mean, one issue is exactly the question you're asking, namely, what's the basis for it? I think the second question, which is in a way a more challenging question, is who exactly is included under it?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you make human rights to be too closely attached to issues like autonomous, rational individuals who are able to determine themselves, set their own goals, and be able to realize them, and enable others to realize their goals as well. Now, that's a very strong notion of what a human being is, and so there's a lot of issues then that start to arise. Well, what about if somebody's disabled? As it were, they're born of biologically human parents, but they have some disabilities. Do these people have human rights, too, even though they can't live what one might call full human existence? And I think that's kind of the trickier area, right? Who's included in these human rights? Because I do think that the notion of human rights is very much closely tied to what it means to live an ideal human existence. It isn't directly tied to the idea of being born of biologically human parents. And so in a sense, this is also connected, I think, to the theological basis of human rights,
right,
whereby human is something that we become, right? We are born animals, Homo sapiens, but we have the capacity within us, and this is where the soul and those kinds of entities become relevant, to, as it were, realize this kind of higher nature that we have that isn't just animal. But then the question becomes, well, what do you need to have to be able to do that? And just being born of biologically human parents is not sufficient, actually. And so I think there is a real tricky question about what do you do about disabled people? What do you do about people who, for various reasons, only have certain levels of intelligence and so forth? I think there's a real kind of tricky political issue there, because human rights is basically about living an ideal human existence, which to a large extent takes us away from our animal nature.
Do you think it's tricky only for the Darwinist worldview?
Oh, I think it's tricky for everybody, frankly, okay? I think it's really tricky, especially if you want to design societies where everybody can realize their human rights. And this is where I think something like eugenics, and when I say eugenics here, I'm not talking about the eugenics that tries to get rid of human life, kind of like the sort of Nazi-style weeding business. I'm not talking about that kind of eugenics. I'm talking about the positive eugenics, the whole idea that, in a sense, we need to grow the sort of beings that can actually become human, so that we should aim toward having certain kinds of people in the society because they're the ones that can really fully realize existence. Now, we don't normally think about this in genetic terms. I think we think about this more in educational terms. So we want people to have certain kind of education, both secular and religious, and that enables them to live full human lives. But actually, the program of positive eugenics had very much the same sort of goals, but believed that you should tackle it at the source being, you know, the biological nature. And Darwin, for example, thought that was never going to work. Okay, and of course, the history of this is, as you know, very checkered, to say the least.
Right.
And we're still in that business, of course, because biotechnology is really just the 21st century version of eugenics.
In the play, Darwin says he's comforted to think of himself as closer to a baboon than a tribesman. Was Darwin a racist, and did his theory of natural selection encourage racism in others?
Well, look, I think Darwin was about as much of a racist as anyone was back then. I mean, so, for example, a race in the 19th century meant a subdivision of a species, right? So in other words, species is typically defined as a group of organisms that can interbreed and produce fertile offspring. And typically what defined a species was a sort of geographical co-location. So all these creatures live relatively near each other, and so they breed with each other. Now, of course, there's migration that takes place over the course of natural history, and also in response to environmental pressure. And this causes then a species to sort of subdivide. And this is where you start to get the possibility of races. And as it were, two races becoming two species, once the genetic contact between the two is sufficiently segregated over a long enough period of time. Okay? And so that, I think, would be the general understanding of races back in Darwin's day. And I think that what you end up getting is people making different judgments about whether these two segregated groups in some way would it be beneficial or advantageous or make sense for them to interbreed again once they've separated out. So you imagine, let's say, a common origin to humanity somewhere, whatever, Africa, the Near East. But then you imagine that, you know, there's migration. Some settle in Europe, some settle in Africa. And then over time, they sort of develop their own kind of genetic makeup that's conducive to their environments. Question is then, should they get back together again? Okay? And I think a lot of people in Darwin's day, perhaps even Darwin himself, sort of believed that there was just a limited extent to which you could actually have integration. That in a sense it would be just very destabilizing for all the populations involved. So do you call that racist? Well, yes, it is a kind of scientific racism based on the science of the time, but I don't think it was a particularly malicious racism. If you're thinking about racism as a view that in some sense is against a certain race, I don't think that's the way to look at this. I think it's rather sort of a view of what enables people to live as peacefully as possible on the Earth.
In your play, the characters discuss sensitive areas like race that you've alluded to, rights, public policy. Have scientific categories like race based on morphology been wrong in the past and wrongly used to influence law and public policy? And is there a present danger that we'll repeat recent mistakes by unearned deference toward the promise of genetics to reshape even human nature? And can the same be said for other things like climate change science and other scientific controversies?
I think you're right, and the first point you raised is correct. See, look, any issue having to do with science is always in flux. So you're always a hostage to fortune if you decide to sort of freeze science at a certain point and make it a basis for public policy. I think that's just a general point, and I think in a sense you suffer the consequences. And I think in the case of using was known about the nature of race at a given point in history and say, okay, now we've got race sorted out, now we can organize our society, even though the science is still going on, that could lead to disaster, of course. I think the climate change issue today is another good example of that, where the science is very much in flux. Nevertheless, people want to kind of freeze frame it and say, look, we know this now. Now we can take these very drastic measures on the basis of it. And so the point is that science changes over time as new evidence comes in, as people reconceptualize stuff. And so I just think that the kinds of issues you're raising are a general kind of proviso that needs to be put whenever science is used as a basis for public policy. Of course, you need to have science inform public policy, but it always should come with a warning label, and that at the end of the day, politicians are the ones who need to take responsibility, and the public needs to take responsibility for whatever decisions they make, and that they can't just sort of, as it were, offload it and say, well, the science says so, because the science will say lots of different things under lots of different circumstances. And sometimes I worry that a lot of the so-called science-driven policies that we have, whether we're talking about race policies or climate change policies, are just ways for politicians to avoid taking responsibility.
We hope you've enjoyed this conversation with Professor Stephen Fuller about his play Lincoln and Darwin, One Night Only. This has been a podcast of ID the Future from the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. If you'd like to learn more or to support the Center for Science and Culture, please go to idthefuture.com and click the yellow donate button. This podcast is copyright 2012, the Discovery Institute. All rights reserved.